Welcome to the 275th episode of Objectively Speaking. My name is Jennifer Grossman. I'm the CEO of the Atlas Society. I'm very excited to have Professor Wilfred McClay with us to talk about his two books, Land of Hope, An Invitation to the Great American Story, and his newest book, Jewish Roots of American Liberty, The Impact of Hebraic Ideas on the American Story. Wilfred, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, Jennifer.
So our guests, our audience always likes to learn a little bit about our guest's origin story. If I understand correctly, you grew up aspiring to be an engineer. What changed your trajectory?
Not really.
No?
My father was an engineer. My father would have loved it if I had had his talents in that area, but I didn't. And, you know, I was mostly a jock in high school. That was main. And at some point, my intellectual interests were fired by a variety of sources. Actually, I hate to admit it now, but the person who really got me going was Emerson. Reading Emerson in was the 10th or 11th grade when you do American literature, and you know, the virtue, the his essay on self, and I just, you know, that always has to click with adolescent.
So you moved to,
whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist, and you know, to be great is to be misunderstood. Unfortunately, the reverse of that is not true. But anyway, all of that kind of rebellious, individualistic, and ambitious kind of sense of the potential of one's own mind really turned me on, and I was hopeless after that.
So you,
but I wasn't interested in history at first. That took a
while. So you moved to Hillsdale as the Victor Davis Hanson Chair 3 years ago. I'm wondering, as an avid jazz piano player, have you found fellow musicians to jam with?
Right, how do you know all these things about me?
Because I read the books and I do my research.
Well, no, the answer is no. I've been trying to assemble a group, and just have it. The long story, version of the story, short version is no, I haven't, and I'm in lack of it. However, I keep acquiring pianos. I was able to acquire a Fender Rhodes piano, which those of your listeners know about these things. Now that's a kind of prize item. They don't make them anymore. And I have a Yamaha Grand and a Yamaha Upright. So I have plenty of instruments around me to keep me going. But I would like to find. It's a little isolated place. So jazz, there are no jazz. You have to go to Ann Arbor.
Well, maybe this interview will help us ferret out some of the jazz players, and we can.
What we need is a bass player.
Okay.
Drummers are easy to find. A bass player, like a good man, is hard to find.
All right. So now I realized that we probably should have done two interviews because this book, The Jewish Roots of Liberty, of American Liberty, is worth an interview in and of itself. But of course, American history is a vast and sprawling topic. So I'm going to spend at least the first 30 to 40 minutes talking about your book, Land of Hope. And what was the inspiration? Gratitude here is a big theme at the Atlas Society.
Yeah.
And you've said that you wanted to write a book that inspires gratitude rather than guilt. So what does gratitude mean in a civic or moral sense?
Well, it's an appreciation of how extraordinary our culture is, our civilization, our way of life, and that it didn't come from nowhere. It didn't come from out of the imagination solely of those living, although certainly be wrecked by those living if we don't do something with what we inherited. But actually the impetus was something more specific. It was when 2014, the people who do advanced placement testing in U.S. history, the College Board, they changed the structure of the test in a way that was very oriented towards, for example, they didn't spend much time at all around the country on the Constitution, the debates over the Constitution, the ratification debates, you know, the Federalist Papers, this kind of stuff. It's even George Washington just kind of dropped away. And instead, there was this focus on the economic history of the early part of the country, and especially on slavery. And the sort of arguments that have been made in the last few years, I think they're starting to knock down, but that slavery was the basis of American wealth, basis of capitalism. I don't know whether you know Philip Magnus, but he's a wonderful economic historian who's taken all of this on in the 1619. So it came out. My book came out the same year as the 2019, as the 19 project of the New York Times came out, and so it wasn't a response to that, but it might as well have been. In a way, because that was the sort of image of American history that I was, and Howard Zinn's In People's History of the United States, that I was pushing against.
Right.
Although you wouldn't know it from reading the book.
No.
Howard Zinn says this, and I say,
yeah, the book definitely needs like a narrative and less like a textbook. And I was struck by your choice of art for the book's cover design. It depicts river, waterfall.
I put so much effort into that. Well, because what I wanted was something I focused very early on the New York skyline as viewed from the water. Which, you know, if you've ever ridden the Staten Island Ferry or, you know, had the occasion to see that, it's a great, great sight, has been for over 100 years a great sight. And I thought it's such a testimony to the dynamism and the majestic dynamism, if you will, of American life. And I wanted to find a picture that gave you the same feeling, the kind of feeling you get when you go into a cathedral and you see there's this huge movement of space upward. You're lifted up by it. I wanted to present the New York City skyline in the same way.
Well,
so it took forever to find, but I found the right piece, and thank you for pointing it out.
It struck me in particular, of course, Ayn Rand loved the New York skyline. The cover depicts the famous skyscrapers of Manhattan in the 1900s during the later years of the Gilded Age. And I think of Ayn Rand arriving in New York in 1926, then heading to Chicago, another city known at the time for its feats of engineering and the stunning skyscrapers.
Indeed.
How do you think... How was that kind of, this was her first real introduction to America. And what do you think that image expresses that's just uniquely American?
Well, it's inventiveness, it's energy, it's and capitalism. The power of capital when it's put to use and is allowed to be deployed freely, just the energy of a free people. That's what it conveys to me. But I also wanted, I didn't want so many surprise, so many of the cover designs for textbooks deal with these sort of Grant Wood images of agriculture. And of rural life and small town life. And that's part of the story.
Right.
I mean, I live in a very small town right now, and I actually love it. New York City, and right now I'm sort of grieving the election of a socialist as mayor of New York, but and I don't think any good is going to come of it. But It's arguably the greatest city in country in the world. Maybe not anymore in the world, but it has been for much of our history.
Right.
In
well,
America, you know, in the financial center.
Yes, we will see. It's New York's loss, but probably Florida's gain. So,
well, in population, yes.
Well, in capital, that's actually what I was thinking of in particular. Now, one of the recurring themes throughout the history you cover is the tension between fidelity to the Constitution and those who believed it was an outdated document, unsuited to the needs of a modern nation. Now, we've spent some time in recent weeks focusing on the Civil War era, debates about the Constitution in Lincoln and Frederick Douglass's era. In the 20th century, what politicians or movements do you think most challenge the relevance of our founding documents?
Well, the progressive movement. And even someone who in many respects I admire, Theodore Roosevelt, had very low opinion of the Constitution. But his famous statement during the anthracite coal strike, he said, the hell with the Constitution when the people need coal. And, you know, I'm not on board with that rule of law. But much, much, much worse than T.R. was Woodrow Wilson. And Woodrow Wilson had maybe the most prominent professor in our political life. He's not the only, I suppose Obama was a professor. That doesn't exactly inspire confidence either, but he had formulated ideas long before he became president about ways that the Constitution would be altered. And even in 1912 and 1913, when he comes into office, he's making the argument that we've outgrown the Constitution, that we need to look at government not as a Newtonian science, the science of government, but as a Darwinian science, and so that institutions evolve the way organisms evolve, and this included a very low of the Declaration of Independence, of the idea that we have natural rights that are part of our endowment, part of our very nature to have these rights, and that government exists primarily to protect those rights. That's the vision of the founders. That's the vision of the Declaration. And that's been, I think, under fire. That's what, in a way, a lot of it boils down to the individual wise American have. Does the Constitution exist to protect those rights? And if it does, you know, I think we tinker with it at our peril.
Right. One of the lesser known tidbits of history that ended up playing a larger role in America's emergence as a great industrial power was the introduction of standard time zones, which we just had a change recently. This is the East Coast time, and this is the West Coast time, and this is Central time. So fans of Atlas Shrugged will be keen to learn how the introduction of standard time zones actually grew out of the needs of the railroads. Can you tell us a little
bit? Yeah, they did the whole thing. It wasn't the government. It was, it goes into, Jennifer, the last thing we were talking about, which is the progressive movement, and it's dangerous because progressives had the view that there was a science of administration. It could be compiled and passed on to a sort of battalion of experts, a sort of clerisy, a ruling class that would be disinterested, never pursuing their interests, but would administer government on the basis of this disinterested knowledge. And the idea of the profit motive of people striving to better their own condition, this was not part of the picture anymore. Well, so you might think that, well, standard time zone, something government would institute. No, it was the titans of industry, the men operating the railroad, who, you think of a transcontinental railroad, if you don't have a way to coordinate trains, you don't have an infinite number of tracks, you have to be able to coordinate the movement of traffic on a finite set of tracks over long periods of time. Well, if you measure time particularly by where the sun is at its zenith, at wherever you happen to be, then you have no standard of the measurement of time, no basis for integrating a far-flung net of transportation.
Right.
But with the invention of the telegraph, which is extremely important, it's like the nervous system, and standard time zones were a necessity, but it wasn't. It was an agreement among the otherwise fiercely competitive.
Right. Well, back to Alexander, it was the Nat Taggart and the founder of the Taggart Transcontinental. One of the things that always annoyed me is how the great industrialists of that time, the same entrepreneurs that Ayn Rand lionized in Atlas Shrugged, are referred to pejoratively as robber barons. How did that depiction come about, and in what ways was the criticism either justified or unjustified?
I think it came about because some of the tactics that were, it's fiercely competitive time. And the railroads were built by people who were entrepreneurs. They had to amass and marshal huge amounts of capital. And that's all true of all forms of big business in the Gilded Age. And that, this is unprecedented levels of capital just to build and operate a steel mill. You made a single farthing off of it. And with the railroads leading example of big business in this time, you have a lot of companies, independent operators who, build, there was no standardization of gauge. So that going from one line to another could be a very complicated business. You might have to hire all the cars in a train onto another train, and that made transportation slower to integrate all of that standard these things. But it also meant that the Cornelius Vanderbilts and others who were the real dominant figures in that industry had to drive off the competition. So sometimes they would use tactics that they would be referred to as buccaneer capitalism. They would use the tactics to eliminate the competition and consolidate what needed consolidating in order for trains to be efficient. But I think the other part of the answer to your question is that vast fortunes were being made. And we see this happening now, tech world. I just saw that there's talk that Elon Musk may be the nation's first trillionaire. Most of us, I think I can speak for a lot of people. I don't really have a problem with Elon Musk making a lot of money because he also does things that are tremendously beneficial to everybody else. I don't mean that I have a completely and critically endorse everything, and so on. But I think there is in some a tendency towards
envy.
What can only be called envy.
Yeah,
it's envy.
Well, that's one of the reasons that I think that I particularly celebrate Elon Musk's and others who have accumulated great amounts of capital. As Elon said, that it's insane to take the job of capital allocation away from those who've demonstrated great skill in
perfectly stated. Yes.
And giving it to an entity, the government, that has demonstrated very poor skill in capital allocation. And it's why in Atlas Shrugged, the strikers, the people that are fleeing, sorry, bit of a spoiler alert here, call their refuge Galt's Gulch. But when you ask John Galt what he called it, he called it Mulligan's Valley. And that was because Mulligan was the great financier. And Ayn Rand herself has said that when people think about wealth, they tend to think that the rich are spending it on luxuries, but that doesn't happen to be the case. That the accumulation of capital is investment. It's the seed corn that drives all innovation.
And it's what is for most of the very wealthy people I know, which are very few, but not interested in. I'll give you an example. A real life example, Jack Miller, who runs Jack Miller Center, which is a wonderful force for educating young Americans about our institutions. Jack made a fortune. I don't know whether he's a billionaire, but he's close to it, in the office supply industry. And then, I made enough money, decided to retire at 70 or whatever. And ever since then, he hasn't just been playing golf and buying mansions and cruise ships. He has been working constantly. I know I'm on his board, so I'm not an objective observer here. But this is a guy in his 90s now, and he is the hardest working man in the business. And because he loves doing that, he loves creating. Does making things happen.
Yes. All right. Well, we could spend the entire interview talking about Elon Musk and the pivotal role of capital investment and Jack Miller, who I'm a big fan, and he's also a supporter of the Atlas Society. But we've got
two books to get to,
and we've also got some audience questions, so I'm going to dip into those right now. Let's see, the couple of similar ones. Alan Turner asks, have you gotten pushback against Land of Hope by the 1619 Project and its supporters? And then My Modern Galt also asks if you have any views about the 1776 Project.
Okay, well, the first one, I haven't really gotten that much pushback. I think that the strategy of the historical profession, which is sort of dominated by people who sympathize with the 1619 Project, even though they know it's bad history. And that's a whole other story. But I've accidentally only had one really thinker of a review, and that was in a socialist publication. So I think I can discount that.
You should wear that as a badge of honor.
Well, mostly
the historical by the social and by the Jacobin.
Yeah. Well, this is that kind of a publication, yes. But no. Mostly they've ignored me, I think that's a kind of strategy. But we're about to come out with a second edition that I hope your listeners and watchers will. We'll be on the lookout for it. It's going to be expanded. It's going to be much better. We are going to try very hard to get that book into public adoption by the state. I think we already have a good line on that. There are things that they wanted in the book to make it a little bit easier for teachers to use it. And we've done those things. We've made those alterations.
Thoughts on the 1776 Project?
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to it. I'm at Hillsdale, and people who did that are not all of them are at Hillsdale, but Matthew Spaulding, Larry Arn, I think, was involved in it. I know Matthew Spaulding, I actually did. The reason I didn't participate in it is that I'm on the National Semi Quincentennial Commission. That's Latin for 250th anniversary of the country, which is coming up next year, and which has been one of the more frustrating experiences of my life, although we're getting rolling now at finally partisan bickering died down. But I felt that, and everybody agreed, I would completely vitiate my credibility on that commission if I identified with the 1776 Project, but I'm quite sympathetic to it. I think 1776 was One of the great moments in human history, the Declaration of Independence, the American Revolution. It's the first time that you have a government come into being on planet Earth saying as a foundational principle that all men are created equal, and that there's an aristocracy is not built into the nature of man, as Jefferson put it.
Well, you know,
not some men.
Yeah, and as you say, it's a story, right? So that it's always able to look back.
Yes.
We can have this sort of presentism where we can critique things, but it was an evolution, and certainly the evolution of Frederick Douglass's views on the Constitution is.
Yes, no, that's very, very. That's a very good example, because he starts out, he's a William Lloyd Garrison. You know, I mean, he starts out as a slave, and then he has this remarkable history of educating himself, being some help, but basically educating himself and becoming one of the finest orators of the 19th century. And he affiliates at first with William Lloyd Garrison, who decries the Constitution, says it's packed with the devil, and it burns a copy of the Constitution, Park Street Church, Boston, and. You know, but he came around, he came to see the Constitution.
And he also had opposing views on Abraham Lincoln as well. So we're about halfway through. We still have a ton to get through on this book as well as the other. So I'm going
to
try.
You have to shut me up, Jennifer, from time to time.
Yes, I will. I'm not.
I take instruction well.
I'm not shy. I will, you know, interrupt you. But there's a few things that I thought were really remarkable about your book. One was talking about the changing composition of immigrants to America around the turn of the century, from Western and Northern Europe to more Eastern and Southern European, as well as Asians. So I'm just wondering if there are any lessons that we can take from that time and apply to today's debates around immigration, particularly with regard to assimilation.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to be careful about but yes, there's a lot of lessons we can learn. One is this country has much more capacity for absorption and adaptation, both of those who come and those who are already here, than we knew. We've done a remarkably good job up to the 1960s of the assimilation of immigrants who are. And I say this all the time, and it's students, that I believe immigration renews the sense of America's promise, because people come here. You mentioned Ayn Rand. There's thousands.
And Elon Musk.
Yeah, and Elon Musk. Yes, indeed. They come here and they kind of look at these skyscrapers and they think, "Wow, this is a place where anything is possible." And so that sense of possibility. Of course, there's risk. Of course, there's a lot of failures. You know, you can't succeed if there's no risk. Can't do great things. Risk failure, falling on your face. But so that's, I think, one of the lessons that. Way is that, you know, people who start out as peasants in Poland can, you know, or as Andrew Carnegie was, a bobbin boy in a mill, and become, you know, great leaders of capital, and also in this case in society. There's so many great things that Carnegie did.
Right.
Libraries.
Well, if anybody hasn't seen it, I highly recommend the streaming series The Gilded Age, and I thought it was did a wonderful job of capturing,
yes,
you know, the grandeur of that time, the ambition, the hustle, and you know, the changing mores of society and social.
We really ought to jump the name Gilded Age, though, because that implies to be gilded. It means to have a fake. It'll be fake gold. They have the appearance of gold, but it's only gilding. It's only a surface veneer sort of thing. And that was when Mark Twain and Charles Dudley Warner published that book and came up with that phrase. It was not as a compliment. Golden age might be better.
Golden age, okay, I'm for it. I hadn't, I had not really thought of it from that perspective, but
always one of my pet peeves.
I think I agree with you. I have many, many pet peeves, and I'm going to adopt that into my collection.
Right. So, no extra charge.
Talk a little bit about the tension in America historically between those wanting to avoid foreign entanglements, as expressed in Washington's farewell address, a warning against permanent alliances, and the desire to take a more proactive approach in world affairs. To what extent was the shift towards the latter prompted by outside events like Pearl Harbor or foreign dictators bent on empire?
Well, I think I think it's much more the latter than the former. I think that when we went into the Spanish-American War, there was this sort of sense of outrage about what the Spanish were doing in Cuba, and Cuba, by the way, I mean, you go all the way back to the party platforms of both parties in the 1860 election, when Lincoln was elected. Was not in the Republican platform, but the Democrats splintered, and all of their platforms included the acquisition of Cuba as part of the party platform of the Democratic Party. The Republicans were not so inclined. There has been Theodore Roosevelt and his retinue, John Hay, Henry Cabot Lodge. These people did think, okay, it's time for us to play with the big boys, and the big boys have empires. We're going to have empires. So there's a kind of emulative. To be a great nation, you had to have art. To be a great nation, you had to have a big navy, and the navy had to have coaling stations all around the world. So you needed those territories, those islands. Alfred Thayer Mahan's Influence of Sea Power on History, big, very important in all of this. But that countercurrent of saying we should stay here and stick to our last, it's also been strong. And the First World War, great reluctance to get involved in that. Wilson finally comes in with this rather pompous notion that he's going to make the world a democracy. The end result was that many Americans came out of the first feeling we had been snookered into, and we did save the day. It's not clear what would have happened, but it seemed as if the Allies were likely without American intervention because the Russians had been pushed out of the war by the revolution. So I mean, it really looked bleak without us. So we did a good thing. A good thing preserving the Western democracies. But a lot of Americans felt that money had been misspent. It was basically propping up the merchants of war, the arms manufacturers. So that underwrote a lot of the reluctance in the 30s to do anything about Hitler. We were fighting before Pearl Harbor. We were already fighting Atlantic, protecting convoys to the British Isles. So it was interesting thing that happened is that Japan attacked. Then Germany declared war. Really.
So in that case,
it didn't have to happen. But anyway, my point is that events, this is really getting back to your question, events, I think, pushed us into playing a role that in some ways we are not suited for, to the extent that we try to be a republic in right. world affairs. And now I think the Cold War kind of continued that. And now I think we're at a juncture where we can start in thinking about, should we return to the Washington, to John Quincy Adams's great speech in 1821, where he says, America goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy, where the We cheer for freedom elsewhere, but with the defender of our own alone. I think that's a very powerful message, and I'm not in favor of what's called isolationism, but I'm in favor of a much diminished. You know, how many military bases do we have around the world? And it's unbelievable.
Well, that is going to get a solid connect with our audience here. But sticking with World War II for a moment, you know, there's been some controversy recently regarding Tucker Carlson's softball interview with figures such as Holocaust denier Nick Fuentes or amateur historian Daryl Cooper, who thinks Winston Churchill and not Adolf Hitler was the chief villain of World War II. So if you're aware of Cooper's theories, what do you make of them in terms of...
You know, I don't know that much about him. I do think that the notion that Churchill is somehow a villain is just preposterous to me. And I don't know what his basis is for that. Well, I know there's a general view that we were on the wrong side. This is a sort of old right kind of position. We were on the wrong side, and that we should have been supporting Germany and opposing Soviets instead of and Bolshevism instead of allying with the Soviets, allying with Stalin. It's interesting. This guy Fuentes is apparently he loves Hitler and he loves Stalin. You know. I mean, it's incoherent. I don't take him seriously as a thinker. I take him seriously as a kind of intellectual hooligan. You know, and I remember guys in high school used like swastikas on their desks. They didn't even know what they were. They just knew it was taboo, so they did it. This is the sort of feeling I get. I mean, I know about Tucker Carlson. I don't. Yeah.
Well, I guess the only thing I would say is if you're going to have somebody who is a Holocaust denier and an anti-Semite on your show, you have a responsibility to push back and be a little bit more critical.
I didn't, the same account
or maybe even a little higher than you hold a Ted Cruz. So, Professor, in your epilogue, you write that, quote, it is in our nature to be belonging creatures, and that we want to be a part of something that brings us together with others. In the sense of creating unity, of course, there's nothing more unifying than finding a scapegoat. And at the moment, it seems that the scapegoat is Israel, and also to an extent from the Nick Fuentes of the world, the Jews. So I just would love to kind of hear a little bit from you historically. Can you tell us, help us put this recent surge in anti-Semitism into the context of American history, say Father Coughlin's popularity, and how have such kind of fevers of bigotry abated in the past?
Well, you know, this is like the robber baron question. You know, the Jews are incredibly successful, and success generates envy, suspicion, a desire to sort of besmirch or to sort of take down people. And I just want to say something. There is a surge of anti-Semitism, but if you look at the polling data about Americans' approval of Israel, it's sky high. So in generality, there are these local elements that, and you know, and look, let me say this. I think I can respect people having qualms about American involvement in the Middle East from the perspective we were just talking about. That is the Quincy Adams, America goes not abroad in search of that kind of thing. I think we need to move cautiously and responsibly in that direction, not lurch in that direction. And so I have some sympathy for people who are nervous about our, you know, taking out the Iranian nuclear facility, which I personally celebrate it. I even popped a cork of worrying about Iran for a long time. But getting back to the reason that I wrote the book along with Stuart Halpern is that this was all underway long before this recent surge of anti-Semitic feeling, which comes in the wake of October 7th, which is very odd, the attacks by Hamas on Israel were unprovoked, and they're unbelievably vicious. I think the American people don't know. There's footage that some of which I've seen, that horrifying stuff that went on. I think most people have not seen that. It's been kind of kept from them. But it was an unprovoked attack. And then it produced almost instantly this anti-Israel, as if Israel was blamed for what had been done to it. So, but let me go back more to your question. I think one of the things we wanted to bring out.
And we're talking, just to be clear now, we're the epilogue was in Land of Hope, but we're saying now to talk about Jewish roots of America.
Right, and what we were thinking about in that was trying to point out, actually to Jewish Americans, how much a part of American history they have been. That was sort of the initial thought, and the book actually started to take shape. We had in mind that it would have just a very limited audience in Jewish day schools. I'm not Jewish, by the way. But I'm interested in the subject. But it kind of took on wings, you know. I want to give one example to your listeners that's really powerful. If you look at after the United States became a country, you know, one of the first things they did was try to make a design for the Great Seal of the United States, stamp that would be on an official document. And they had convened a committee. Thomas Jefferson was on the committee, Benjamin Franklin, a few others. And Jefferson and Franklin both wanted the image on that to be the image of the Exodus from the biblical book, the passage of the Jews from slavery in Egypt and freedom. Jefferson and Franklin, they both wanted this. They are not the most religious people among the founders. Why did they do this? Well, Jefferson, he wrote about this in other places. He thought the Exodus was symbolically an expression of what America would be about, and it would be about freedom, be about liberty. So it's a sort of a connection of the whole religious past of the Western tradition to the modern phenomenon of America. And they didn't get their way, as we know. We don't see the Exodus. But it had a motto. Their design, they proposed a motto, and it is rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. And Jefferson, who's notoriously not orthodox in his religious views, really a free thinker, Jefferson liked this slogan so much he used it as his personal motto on his own stationery. This tells you something about the way in which this most profound of images from the Jewish tradition shaped the consciousness of American founders. Now they didn't adopt this, it's true, but Jefferson and Franklin both wanted
that. Yeah, and that wasn't
the only, amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing, and it's not the only example. I was really taken aback by how much the founders studied the Old Testament and how it influenced them. For example, I was surprised to learn that James Madison studied Hebrew to get a better understanding of characters from the Bible, and that Abraham Lincoln cited the Old Testament approximately three times as often as the New Testament. So yes. Tell us a little bit about that.
No, that's right. That's right. I'm so glad you bring that up. I mean, I think that there has been and Lincoln, of course, was not a churchgoer. He kind of picked up his religion later. He was tended to be again a kind of a free thinker, and actually one of his elections he ran against a religious figure and beat him. But he was drawn to the language of the Hebrew Bible by the experience of the war, and by the sense that, how does this make any sense? How can all this slaughter, all this suffering, is it for nothing? And, you know, he nearly lost. I mean, he could have lost the election of 1864. I mean, we're a constitutional republic. We ran an election in the middle of a civil war. And he was behind. I mean, we didn't have polling or anything like that, but he was convinced he was going to lose the election until Grant and Sherman gave him a couple of big victories that made people think, oh, this thing is going to go on forever. We are finally going to be done with it. But Lincoln, there's a profundity to his religious reflections that, you're right, it's not New Testament, it's the Old Testament. It's the Jewish portion of the Bible.
Right. It's biblical heroes like David, Esther, Samson, yep. Daniel appear throughout the American rhetoric, from the Continental Congress to Martin Luther King Jr. So what makes these figures enduring symbols of the canon of the American imagination?
Well, part of it is that in the early, all the way through the 19th century, it's a religious country. It's a Protestant country, and largely, and Protestants are great, are supposed to be anyway, great readers of the Bible, and they rely on the Bible's authority. If you go back to Puritan, New England Puritan, they were thoroughly imbued in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, and they saw themselves, they're leaving Europe for America, which they called the New Zion. It was a replication of what had happened to the Jews in the their invasion from Egypt. And you see this in their sermons, and this sense that the biblical stories are like a template explaining their condition. Now, that highly religious interpretation of things didn't last. It lasted into the 19th century, but it also becomes transmuted into a kind of secularized view of things. And the heroes of the Bible, the Davids and the Samsons and so on, as Stu Halpert has these wonderful little essays in each one of these biblical stories, and how they become a part of our common speech. In the same way that, Lincoln says, house divided against itself, and that's one of his few New Testament references. But he's not talking about the religious content. This is a phrase everybody knows, because everybody's gone to Sunday school, and everybody's been brought up in the Bible, and the Bible is, we have very high rates of literacy in early America because people are taught to read, because they're taught to read the Bible. Again, a very Protestant thing. Catholics, not so much. They have their missal, they have their priests, they have the sacraments there, and the whole structure of worship. Protestants are, the Bible is the core of it. So there's a lot of biblical, what we would call biblical literacy, and the stories last. The effect, we're not a Jewish country, but we have this Jewish infrastructure of our consciousness, of the stories that we know, and really the stories that we know and share with one another are a big part of what makes a culture, what makes a culture tick. And we when you make reference to, oh, he wants to pull everything down on him like Samson, you know, we may be entering a generation where people don't get that, but certainly my generation, your generation, we do. We know what that refers to, even if we're not, you know, practicing Jews or don't read the Bible as a sacred text. It's
it's part of our heritage. Right. So, you know, in light of the rising anti-Semitism that we talked about earlier, what insights from your book can help us better understand how to deal with this moment and how to lead with, you know, tolerance and not tribalism, but, you know, individualism?
Yeah, I'm struggling with that question myself, because I think
on one hand, could it be just a better understanding of history? I guess I always ask myself how much of this is just a complete lack of grasping civic knowledge, our nation's history, and how much of it is just sort of anxiety and resentment and want an emotional kind of wanting to scapegoat and lash out.
Well, you know, and you used the word earlier in our conversation, the scapegoat. This is the Jews are one of the great scapegoats of. It's interesting because the notion of the scapegoat is itself a part of Jewish heritage. You know, and the story of the Passover involves the slaughter of a man. Anyway, it is the Jews. Because they're so accomplished, they're have habits drilled in. It's a cultural thing of habits of study that have led to Jewish distinction in all sorts of fields, including sciences, including literature, including history. Music. All you name music. Oh my goodness, you know. Yes, fiddler is on many roofs. Yeah, so it's tailor made for, and somehow blaming the Jews. One of my predictions, my sad prediction, that Mondani's election as mayor. He'll have a bunch of terrible ideas. They won't succeed. They'll make things worse. And then whose fault is it?
Of course. He's already
going to be the fault of Hamas.
Yes, he's already made it clear who he believes the blame it should be. And he's
a long line of individuals, including, you mentioned, Father Coughlin. That's a very interesting thing for people to look at if they're not familiar with that history. You know, he was a radio priest from actually not far from where I'm sitting right now in Michigan, and developed a huge following during Depression. And he was in many respects sort of to the left of Roosevelt. There were a lot of people who left to the left of FDR, Huey Long. Really ominous character. Father Coughlin, you know, he started out, you know, all right, and then he got on to these sort of the great malefactors of wealth, the international banker. They were the ones causing all this disruption of the economic system. So it became more and more, he gravitated towards a more and more openly anti-Semitic pitch. His audience was willing to believe it. You know, they wanted to know. They wanted to have somebody to blame. People always want to have somebody to blame for events that are beyond their control. So I worry about that. I worry, look, if you look at the what we've just experienced, the this brutal attack, unprovoked attack on a music festival in Israel, and slaughter, you know, this figurehead, the cutting off women's breasts. I mean, just and videos of it sent home to mama and papa. Look at what I did. There's your educational problem. But we haven't really, except for those of us who are predisposed to hear the bad news, most people want to somehow think, well, you know, maybe the Israelis must have done something worthy of this kind of treatment. And it's when you have that kind of unwillingness on the part of the media to present things as they are, to be honest about the history, to be honest about what it means, how meaningless the charge of settler colonialism is when applied to it. To have our mass media be more willing to face the truth of the matter and thus communicate it to the public.
Right. No, I think you're right. I think we need to have accurate information and objective news. But I think it's more than just bad information. I think it's a question of bad values, and that is the job of philosophy. And that is what we do here at the Atlas Society. You know, when you see success, do you resent it or do you admire and emulate it? Do you see yourself as having agency or do you look at a universe in which things are beyond your control? And I think that to close it up, since we are at the end of the hour, is why it is so important to pick up a copy of Land of Hope as well as Jewish Roots of American Liberty, because in reading about some of these great giants, moral giants of history like Lincoln, we are encouraged to turn to the better angels of our nature and away from the kind of thrill of breaking taboos, some of which are taboos for a good reason. So thank you very much, Professor. What's next for you and where can we follow your work?
I want to do something. I'm working on the book about guilt because I think guilt and manipulation.
That's, we're going to book you back because that's
please do. I've enjoyed this so much. I do lots of interviews. You are really superb. This is one of the best interviews I've ever had. And so I'm reluctant to go. But yeah, I want to do something about how guilt has become one of the principal forces moving history in the last 100 years, and especially now, and what we can do about it. Because we've got to do something about it. The Western world is suffering from this, what I would call toxic guilt. And its ways of dealing with that have not been good.
Yes, toxic guilt and toxic empathy. So, we will be breathlessly awaiting that, and please keep us informed and we will have you back. So thank you, Professor. Thanks for joining today. Thanks everyone for joining today. Again, apologies. I kind of had two books to cover, so I couldn't get to all of your questions, but I hope you will join us next week when author Daniel J. Flynn joins us to talk about his new book, The Man Who Invented Conservatism, The Unlikely Life of Frank S. Meyer. We'll see you then.